The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Good evening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti, licensed psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. And I'll be your host this evening for our discussion on chronic mental illness, signs, symptoms, and treatment. I'm joined in the studio by licensed professional counselor, Andy Sibley. And Andy, you also do some teaching and some writing. You have a private practice in Shreveport. Is that correct?
I do. I work in Shreveport in private practice, working with couples and families and individuals. I teach. I'm an adjunct teacher at Louisiana Tech at their Barksdale Air Force Base area. It keeps me pretty busy, and I'm doing some writing. I'm finishing up a weight loss book. Okay. I want to get that out probably in the next month or so.
So you have a weight loss book. Any other books that you have?
Not right now. I've got a couple of plans for a couple, some parenting books, kind of stuff. Yeah.
You're a dad.
Yep, yeah. I'm a dad. Got two girls, wonderful girls.
So we're going to be talking about chronic illness, chronic mental illness, and I wanted to start by just talking about what deems a mental illness chronic.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's important that there a chronic mental illness is an ongoing, a persistent mental illness, and when it's chronic and it's persistent and it affects a large portion, or it really affects someone's lifestyle, then it becomes a serious mental health issue. And chronic just means it's been going on a long time. It's not real recent, or it doesn't come and go a lot.
So if someone had just one depressive episode, we wouldn't necessarily consider that chronic. It might be a very severe depressive episode. But if they had repeated depressive episodes, then we would consider that to be chronic.
Yes. And when you're evaluating someone and assessing someone, you want to find out if their issues are have been brought on recently, if it's a single episode, like you said, with depressive symptoms, or if it's an ongoing thing that they've been battling for years. Mm-hmm. It makes a difference on how you treat them.
Because a lot of the illnesses that we deal with as counselors and psychologists, most of them can become chronic if they continue. So about 1% of the adult population in the U.S. is considered seriously mentally ill. So what would you consider serious mental illness?
Well, I think as a counselor, when we are working with somebody and trying to assess their chronic mental illness, it's certainly, like I said before, if it's lasted a long time, if it's persistent, and it's really affecting their lifestyle, it's affecting maybe their relationships and their family, their work, having a lot of difficulties, that's when we consider it a serious mental health. Sometimes if it needs medication to help, then that's one of the things we evaluate if it's a more serious mental illness.
So if the person is having difficulties in many areas of functioning, so they're having some problems maybe at work and then maybe also at home, and so this is impacting them in many different ways.
Certainly, like the example you gave of severe depression. I mean, that people get depressed occasionally, and they get the blues, and they may get really sad or get depressed. That certainly during the grieving process, I think that's pretty normal. But when it's so severe that it's really affecting their functioning, it's affecting relationships. I've worked with people that really have a hard time getting out of bed and sleeping at night and getting out of bed and going to work, so they're at risk of losing their job. It may start to impact their relationships, where they're looking at maybe divorce or breakup of a relationship. And when we see that, we can see that it's pretty severe. It needs to be treated pretty quickly.
Yeah, because when we diagnose somebody with a major depressive disorder, that's not just the blues.
Right.
You know, it's not just a bad day or even a few bad days or even bereavement. It's pretty normal to grieve after someone dies, after a loss. But if that continues on, then we might diagnose a depressive disorder. So are there particular mental disorders that are typically considered more serious or more likely to become chronic?
Certainly, I think the severe depression that you talked about is one. There are some anxiety disorders. Again, if obsessive compulsive disorder or another anxiety disorder is chronic enough and big enough and impacting their life enough, it can be a pretty severe or a serious disorder. Bipolar disorder is one that we consider more of a serious condition. Schizophrenia type of disorders, eating disorders can be if they're severe enough. There's different kinds of psychotic disorders that I think would fall into that group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and you were talking about the anxiety disorders. Agoraphobia is one that can be quite debilitating because that person has a fear of leaving their home or being in spaces where there are a lot of people, and so that can be quite debilitating. And then also eating disorders, those can be fatal.
Yes, yes. Yeah. They have the highest incidence of death rates of all the mental disorders.
Yeah, so that, you know, these are very serious disorders that can really impact and hinder a person's ability to function, but also can be life-threatening if not treated properly.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So how are there signs that people should look for, or that family members should look for, that they're concerned that maybe someone's blues or anxiety or something like that is turning more serious or more chronic? What should people look for or kind of be on the lookout for?
Well, what I've seen many times is when you're talking about a chronic serious mental health disorder, usually family members, if not the person themselves, are aware that this has been going on a long time. So they can recognize that this has been going on for several years with teenagers and kids. Sometimes when I talk to family members, they noticed it, that this kind of set in at 12 years old, or when this person turned about 16, we started seeing some of these behaviors. So they can really, I look for timelines and find out when some of these symptoms started showing themselves. And we kind of work from there. As far as families recognizing some things, certainly with depression, the sleeping a lot, the not engaging with people. I guess post-traumatic stress disorder I see sometimes has some of this depression and things going along with that. But isolating themselves, and it can start to impact their jobs and put them at risk, like I said, of losing their jobs or losing time away from their jobs, and certainly distancing themselves from their family members. So usually people come in because their spouse made them mm-hmm. or whatever. Yeah. So that's what I see a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes we'll see hygiene, you know, differences in hygiene. The person just isn't changing their clothes or, you know, getting out of bed to brush their teeth or, you know, things like that. And like you said, a lot of isolation, a lot of what we call anhedonia, so just not really enjoying anything. They used to enjoy going bowling or going to the movies, and now they don't really want to do much of anything. So those are, as you said, the things you mentioned, and then the things I added, those are usually, you know, what we look for.
Sure.
When we're determining is this significant, and when we're advising people as to, you know, what they need to be looking for.
Sure.
As signs and others. So we talked a little bit about, you know, that these mental disorders can impact several different areas of functioning, or, you know, work, school, family life, etc. What changes might we see in these areas of functioning, or what impairments might be evident in these different areas of functioning, like work, school, home, that sort of thing?
Certainly. I think with the more like the mood disorder, like bipolar disorder, you're going to see differences in energy levels and moods. We consider it a mood disorder, but it's a thinking disorder, feeling disorder as well. But you may see people not sleeping, and it's starting to affect their jobs or their ability to sleep. Some anger issues. Sometimes people are sent to me through their jobs or through their HR for anger management. And when you dig down deeper, there could be some depression going on or some kind of manic episode. Certainly, there's different forms of psychosis where people see or hear things or sense things that no one else sees or hears. And that's an indication a lot of times that family members can pick up on.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, this is a term that probably most of the listeners will not be familiar with, but the term dual diagnosis, which us in the mental health field, we use this term a lot. Would you just describe to the listeners what a dual diagnosis is?
Certainly. A dual diagnosis is where there's more than one concern that you're needing to treat at the same time. So they're happening at the same time. So sometimes we'll see people with depression and they have a substance abuse issue going on, or they may have some medical problems going on with diabetes that needs to be treated, their thyroid function may be off. So it could be a medical condition, or it could be another mental health condition. Mm-hmm. People with depression sometimes have some anxiety, and so there may be some dually things going on.
Yeah, and with some of these disorders, we'll see a substance use disorder.
Yes.
I know I see quite a few people with PTSD, and sometimes in an attempt to kind of ameliorate or help with their symptoms, there'll be alcohol use or marijuana use or something like that.
Certainly, a codependency or a coping mechanism that they develop, just to be able. Some people say, you know, I just need to escape for a little while, or just need to not think about this, or I can't turn my brain off. I'm really feeling sad, so I'm gonna do some drugs or drink to make myself get in a better place. That dual diagnosis, not treating one and not treating the other, can lead to it not being as effective.
Sure. So as I was saying, you know, PTSD, if you treat the alcoholism but the PTSD is still there, then the chances of relapse are going to be very, very high.
Certainly. And you've taken away a very primary coping mechanism for them.
Yeah.
And you need to replace it.
They don't have that coping mechanism, and it hasn't been replaced with a healthy mechanism to cope.
Yeah. Correct.
And again, we are joined this evening by Andy Sibley. He is a licensed professional counselor and is in private practice in Shreveport, Louisiana. So we talked a little bit about substance abuse. Are there other diagnoses that you can think of that tend to be associated with chronic mental illness?
Many times, like I said, the medical conditions, and so when you're assessing someone for a mood disorder or depression, many times you can get some information about their health. I've worked with people who seem depressed, and they're showing some classic signs of depression, but they have uncontrolled diabetes.
Mm-hmm. or thyroid
issues. Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. And the typical things when you talk about, oh, I've put on weight lately and I don't have any energy and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to look for, or you have to rule out some physical conditions that may be contributing to that before you can truly start to work on some other things. And that's including, I know in the hospital with working with some of the elderly patients, they would come in and really have some psychosis and really seeing things that weren't there and being really paranoid, and they had a bladder infection.
Yeah, yeah. Often it'll dehydration.
Dehydration.
Mm-hmm. Significant dehydration in the elderly, and you'll see those really, really prominent psychotic features. And if you just get them, you get them hydrated, or if you treat that bladder infection, it goes away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, certainly. And then the other side of that with young kids and teenagers, I mean, certainly their functioning is going to be difficult in the school. You're going to see it more in the school. With kids, there tends to be more changes in behaviors as opposed to kids are going to be moody sometimes, especially teenagers, but you're going to start to see some changes with their eating habits and their study habits and who they're hanging out with, their friends and stuff like that, or they're not hanging out with friends, not doing the things. I've had teenagers that quit the ball teams and stuff like that, just not interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll see some of those similar symptoms. They just may express themselves differently in children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have a caller. We have Billy on the line. Billy, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, my question, well, let me give a little backstory first. I've had issues with my mother for years, and I've always suspected that she's been mildly depressed. I've talked to her about it, I've talked to my dad about it, and, you know, of course, it didn't do any good. But the last 2 years, she's been picked up drinking, and it's gotten out of hand. And my dad and my brother called me a couple days ago and asked me to come over for an intervention or asking my advice what, you know, what they need to do if they've had enough. And my question is, how do you go about getting someone, because she's not going to go on her own to talk to someone. How do you go about getting someone to talk to a doctor, a physician, a psychiatrist, a counselor, or whoever to kind of get a process going of getting some sort of diagnosis?
Yeah, so Billy's question, it's one we hear pretty frequently, and it's one that's difficult to answer because it's a sticking point for a lot of families, a lot of people with loved ones who have mental health issues. Andy, do you have any suggestions?
Well, I think they're on the right track with doing an intervention and sitting down with love and caring for this person and talking about their concerns for her. I guess my question would be if she's been treated for depression in the past, is she on any kind of medication? If she's already working on that, then that may be a door to get in and start to work on the substance abuse. Has she been in treatment or on medication for depression?
I believe she had about 8 years ago she was on, and don't give me the line about what it was, but she was on a mild antidepressant about 8 years ago, but I don't think she's been on it for quite a while.
Okay. And that's what we were talking about as far as chronic serious mental illness. I mean, depression that's been it's been a while and they've had it for a long time. And then this dual diagnosis of having some drinking going along with that as some kind of coping mechanism. And you mentioned that it's especially the last couple of years, it's really gotten bad. So doing an intervention, asking someone to get help, it's really difficult if somebody is not a danger to themselves or others to get them put in a facility to get help against their will. So if it gets to the point where she's really seriously having problems with drinking and it's affecting her, or she gets in an accident or anything like that, a car accident, or if she's acting bizarre or something at the house because of that, it can get to that level. And if it does, sometimes you can reach out and get help. But mostly it's just trying to convince them, but people are going to reach out and get help when they're ready. That's the difficult thing for families.
Yeah, and another suggestion, Billy, might be for you and your family to go to a counselor without her and talk with the counselor about how to best approach her. And also there are groups out there, just like they have Alcoholics Anonymous. They have that for family members of alcoholics, and maybe getting some support from others that are in a similar situation, getting some advice from them might be helpful. We have another caller. We have Tina from California. Tina, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, I was just going to say what she had said, that we need to go counseling for ourselves. I have family members that also had different issues. And we went for counseling to show us how we can do it to help, you know, our parents, what they were going through. And that worked really good, because as we were able to learn more about the situation, we were able to get in with more members. And so as they came to sit around the table, or we had a barbecue, or we had a family dinner at a restaurant or something, we knew how to work with them. It's best to educate ourselves, because the person that is going through it is only reaching out for a supplemental, you know, drinking or staying on their own or sheltering themselves. But I would suggest that family members would go for counseling on their own, not just with their pastors, but other places where they do have counseling. You know, look around, pray about it, and see where, you know, you'll be able to help your loved one.
Thank you, Tina. We really appreciate that firsthand knowledge and advice.
Certainly.
Yeah. So it's a very frustrating problem for a lot of families, and it's difficult because it's hard to see your loved one suffering. And you know, that's very painful to watch. But really, unless someone is a danger to themselves or others, meaning suicidal or homicidal, we really can't force people into treatment. We can gently nudge.
Yeah, And that's really true. And I liked what Tina was saying as far as educating yourself and family members taking it on themselves. Like, how can I be a better cousin or child or a parent to this person that needs some help, and reaching out and getting their own help. Sometimes we work on, you know, when to confront somebody, when not to confront somebody, how best to work with them. And people come in and say, well, I just pour the booze down the drain, and that's how I deal with it. And that may not be the best way to deal with it.
Yeah.
And so it can be really, really helpful to educate yourself about what are common things with people that are abusing substances, and especially if they have a mental disorder.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And again, I'm joined by Andy Sibley, who is a licensed professional counselor and has a private practice in Shreveport, Louisiana. So we're already kind of talking about family and what families can do. Monitoring, kind of keeping an eye on folks who have chronic mental illnesses is important. Would you talk a little bit about how we do that and why we do that?
Well, you're right. It is very important, and because family are have more vested interest in the well-being of their family members. If they don't live with them or whatever, being able to check on them and see how they're doing, seeing if they're taking their medication, if they're on medication, make sure they're eating properly and those kind of things. So it's really important to kind of monitor people, because if you don't see them very often, and sometimes some of the patients that may see their psychiatrist and they're on medication, they may not see that psychiatrist but every 6, 8 weeks, 9 weeks. And so it's really hard to monitor how the medication's helping. Are they taking care of themselves? And so it's really nice as a counselor that I get to see people more often. And so I can kind of check with them and see how they're doing. But a lot of times I try to get information from family members that are checking on them a little more often, making sure they're, like I said, eating and that kind of thing, and monitoring their health and making sure, because many of the as the symptoms get bigger, like with depression, if someone's starting to have some suicidal ideation, some suicidal thoughts, or some psychosis, you can see it coming on many times. And so usually family members kind of notice it, and they can kind of monitor that a little better, and they can either inform the counselor or let their loved one know that they're noticing a change. That may be really helpful.
Yeah, and if family members are busy and they can't necessarily check on someone every day or even once a week, there are programs. There are day programs, partial hospitalization programs that are available, and those programs provide group counseling and also, you know, make sure that their medications are straight and that sort of thing. And most areas have those kind of programs.
Certainly.
Through hospitals or other kind of organizations.
Yes. And we have what's called an ACT team, an acute care treatment team, a couple of agencies around here locally that do that, and they can check on folks really often, and they can adjust their meds as needed really quickly. So they're kind of a crisis team that can go mm-hmm. out into the home and check on folks.
Yeah, and a lot of these programs will provide transportation. They will go to the patient's home, pick them up, bring them to the hospital, provide that treatment, take them back home. So even if a family member isn't able to be there as frequent as they would like, then check into some of these programs that could help assist with some of that monitoring.
Certainly, yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah. So what about continuity of care? I know, you know, we're always very concerned about that in the mental health field. Would you, for the listeners, just kind of explain what that is and why that's important?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things here. The continuity of care and also a collaboration of care. Both of those things I think are really important. When I think of continuity, I think of having the same counselors, the same doctors, the same physicians, people that have a history. I know I've talked to doctors and that work with breast cancer survivors and being able to, when they're getting tested or x-rayed or whatever, doing a mammogram on women, that continuity of knowing what the history is the best way to treat. So when a person's going from doctor to doctor to doctor, sometimes patients will see a psychiatrist for a little while and then not like what they're doing and go see another one, or they see whoever and that person doesn't have a good connection to them, that can be problematic. So trying to have some kind of continuity of care that you have somebody that gets to know these people and they know their habits, they know their cycles, how they do things. And the collaboration of care is really important. Really try to do that in my practice, is stay in touch with doctors and family members and get that collateral information from other people so that I can put those things together.
Yeah, because often with someone with a chronic mental illness, a serious mental illness, there's going to be a team treating them. There may be a psychiatrist that's doing medication or a medical psychologist that's doing medication, and then there may be a counselor who is doing therapy, and then maybe a psychologist who does some testing. And so there are usually a lot of different folks who are providing care, and it's really important that all of those folks communicate so that everybody's on the right page. You know, if a medication is changed, then the counselor sees some changes in behavior, then they need to be able to get in touch with the psychiatrist and discuss those things. So yeah, everybody kind of being on the same page. And I usually recommend that patients kind of view finding a new doctor like buying a new car. You don't buy a car without test driving.
Yeah.
Give them a test drive, and if you feel like it's a good fit, then stick with them, because there are going to be things in counseling and also sometimes from your psychiatrist you're going to be told that you may not like.
Certainly.
Because part of our job is to kind of push and gently nudge, and sometimes, the things that we bring up are difficult or we don't really want to hear. So, like I said, I really encourage people to pick somebody that they feel really good with, and then stick with them through the thick and thin.
certainly. And when I have new patients coming in to see me, or they call and they want to know things about me, I try to be really clear. It's like, check out my website. Let me, ask me any questions you have. I want to make sure you're comfortable. Are you comfortable with a male therapist? Are there things that any questions you have? And then if you come in and see me and after the first visit, we just don't click and you don't feel like I get your symptoms or I get you, then I'll help you find another counselor. Cause I agree. It's like buying a car. You want to test drive it, and you also want to look into it a little bit, and you want to make sure it's a good fit for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's an investment.
Sure. Certainly.
Yeah. I do the same thing, and I think it's important for people to know that our feelings don't get hurt. We want to know if it's not a good fit so that we can refer you to somebody that might be a better fit, because our goal is for people to get better.
Certainly. Certainly.
Yeah. So we already kind of touched on this a little bit, the therapeutic alliance. Would you talk a little bit about that and maybe a little bit about why that's important?
Okay. Well, the therapeutic alliance is kind of refers to the counselor and the patient kind of connecting and having an alliance of what direction they're going to go in. And so it's important that the client feels safe, that the therapist is there for them and understands them and understands their conditions, and they're working together. It's a little bit of a dance, and when I'm when I'm teaching and kind of talking about it, I refer to counseling as kind of an art, and you want to have a bag of techniques, and but it's an art to know when to use them and when to ask questions and when to confront and when not, and when let people just kind of vent a little bit, and when you need to challenge some of their thinking. But it's really important that the counselor and the client get an understanding and build that alliance and work through this process together.
Yeah, that therapeutic alliance is really, really important, especially in counseling, because it's a very intimate relationship. It's an intimate, non-sexual relationship. But, good therapy really digs in there and gets in there, and so you really need to feel safe and comfortable with this
Certainly.
Person.
It's amazing. Just this week, I had a couple of new people come in, and I was just telling them at the end of the session how brave they were, mm-hmm. and just had met me, and we started talking. We hit it off, and I was really clear about the way I do therapy. I'm more of solution-focused therapy. I do crisis intervention, solution-focused work. And so I'm going to give you my 2 cents, and we're going to go through this at a pace you can handle. But I let them know I'm not going to just sit there and shake my head and say, yeah okay, and just, you know, how do you feel about that all day? And so typically the people that I'm dealing with want to move forward, and so we pick a pace, but that therapeutic alliance has to be there so that they trust me and they can open up and talk to me, but also that I can trust them. And that I'm not going to push them too hard, I'm not going to push them too fast, but they're going to come in and they're going to do the work and do what they need to do to get better as well.
Yeah.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We already kind of touched a little bit on family involvement, but I'd like to talk a little more about why it, especially with chronic and serious mental illness, why it is so important for families to try to be involved, to try to kind of have a team approach, not only the professionals, but also the families being part of that treatment team.
Certainly. I think it's so helpful when you can have family and you can have friends that are involved. Many times people with serious mental health conditions don't have a lot of insight. And so they may not see that they're being kind of paranoid, or they may not see that they haven't left the house in several days, or they haven't taken a shower or a bath in 3 or 4 days. Just maybe out of their awareness that things are not doing well for themselves. So sometimes family members, again, that monitoring side can be really helpful. I think it's important for me personally, and as a counselor, that when I can, I try to get family members to come in and meet with me, either with the client in the room or with the person not in the room, and I ask them, you know, in your opinion, how's this person doing? When I was working much more with children and kids in school and stuff like that, I got egg on my face a few times, and I was working with a kid. Oh, I'm doing great. My grades are good, and, you know, everything's cool. And then I get a phone call from mom saying, hey, did he tell you he got suspended from school and he's been sitting at home for 3 days? Like, no, we missed that part. So I learned pretty quickly to make sure I'm checking in with parents, and I want to be open with the kiddos that I'm doing that. Now, we have a certain level of confidentiality depending on their age, but I find it helpful to get collateral information. I've called teachers, I've called school counselors, certainly psychiatrists, medical doctors, and kind of just talk to them about different things. But having the family members be involved when they can be, sometimes they're burned out, especially with some of these long chronic conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. They've kind of worn some of the family members out. And so trying to get them to try again, let them see, let's give this treatment option another try. And the more involved you're in, the more success we might have.
Yeah. And it is very difficult for families not to get burned out. It's really easy, as you said, with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, even PTSD. Those disorders can really take a toll, not only on the patient, but also on the families, the friends, the loved ones.
Yeah. Certainly, yes.
What about patient and family education? So, you know, we don't do just do counseling. We also try to educate. Would you talk a little bit about that, why that's important, kind of what we do?
Sure. And one of our callers, Tina, kind of alluded to this with her family members and saying it was really helpful for them to educate themselves. Many times, if someone does have bipolar disorder and I'm meeting with a spouse or a parent or a loved one, we talk about that. And I invite them, I give them maybe some websites to go on and look up what bipolar is, get a better understanding of what the condition is. What are the norms around that so that they can better understand that sometimes if your loved one is bipolar and they get in these deep, dark depressions for no reason, that's part of the condition. It could be. We also talk about, with certain conditions, again, with bipolar, there's typically cycles involved. And some people may have some elevated mood or some mania for a week or two or several days, and then they're back to their normal state and kind of in their mood is okay. And then sometimes they get depressed for a few days, like a month or so later. And so you can start to put that timeline together and see what's normal for them. But certainly educating them about what the condition is, educating people about about the medicine and what to expect from the medicine. I think that's really important to have them educated about the condition and about what's going on. And then I try to educate myself on the family dynamics and what's going on with the family.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment on chronic mental illness. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. And we actually do have a caller. We have Fanny from Benton. Fanny, go right ahead with your question or comment.
What I was calling about is I have a daughter who is 25 who has a lot of mental illness, and we've been working on trying to get her better. Of course, you know, you were talking about how the family gets involved and how therapy is going to help her and that type of stuff, but what I'm wondering is she's not being honest with her therapist, and she's not always being honest with her psychiatrist. But she's not allowing me to, you know, to get involved either. So I don't know how to help her get to such a place where she can be better for herself, because right now she is basically a hermit in our home, you know, and just wondering how we can, I mean, is it appropriate to send a letter to the doctor or to her therapist, and you know, I don't know the right protocols, I guess, is what I'm asking.
That's a good question, because if someone is over the age of 18, they have the right to say, no, I don't want you to talk to that person. So we can't necessarily contact mom or dad or whomever unless we have that patient's permission to do so if they're an adult. So that is a sticking point. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, this is fairly common. We run into this, you know, here and there. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing when you have a daughter that's 25 and she's got some mental health issues and she's living at your house. So some things to kind of think about is, you know, when someone's living at your house, no matter what their age is, you can have certain guidelines and certain needs and sit down and kind of start to negotiate some of these things, and maybe occasionally asking about meeting with the doctor or the therapist. One of the ways that I found to be the most effective for some family members is when they recognize that they need the help. They need help dealing with their daughter. They need help dealing with their loved one. And sometimes if they approach the patient from that standpoint of, I want to be a better mother for you, I want to be a better father for you, would you let me go talk to your therapist so they can teach me how to help you better and be in a better relationship with you? And then once they get in the room, they can kind of maybe learn some things and share some things with the doctor. But without your daughter's permission, the doctor really can't talk to you or anything. You had mentioned, can you send a letter and just say, hey, you know, I know you can't talk to me, but just want to let you know this is my opinion on a couple of things. You can certainly do that. You can call and leave a voicemail and do that, but sometimes that backfires because that's going to get to your daughter, and it could make the what's going on in the house not that much harder.
Yeah, it's really a difficult situation for family members, and a lot of times they'll call and want information, and they don't understand that, you know, our confidentiality, what we have to abide by, you know, as far as confidentiality. But yeah, I agree. Just a lot of times it's very frustrating, and so we come from an irritable, angry place. And if you can try your best to sit that aside and come from as loving and gentle a place as possible, you know, people tend to respond better. I'm not saying that that's necessarily going to work, but I think that, you know, as they say, more flies with honey. You know, you're going to have a better chance than doing a lot of fussing. But you can be very firm in establishing some boundaries and some consequences. And not necessarily doing it in a nagging or angry kind of way.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And I am joined by Andy Sibley. He is a licensed professional counselor, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and he is in private practice in Shreveport, Louisiana. We're talking about families and we're talking about chronic mental illness. And so having emergencies, crises, those can happen sometimes. So would you talk a little bit about contingency plans and why it's important for us to maybe think about having a contingency plan and what that might look like?
Yeah, I really think that it's a very important part of counseling and working with families or working with patients. When I'm talking to teaching my students in college, talking about crisis intervention, the last step in crisis intervention counseling is that contingency plan, is anticipatory planning for the what ifs and what might come up. If someone is drinking and trying to get stop drinking so much or whatever, and they're going to AA and they haven't had anything to drink in 3 months, they still need a contingency plan. What's going to happen if you get that urge? What if you're at a party? What if you're at a friend's house? Or what if something bad happens at work and you still feel that desire to drink? What are you going to do? How are you going to handle that? So we do things like role play. We talk out different scenarios. What are the different triggers that may bring things on? When it comes to severe depression, recognizing what that looks like as it's coming on, recognizing what possible triggers there may be. The same with many of these chronic disorders, PTSD, whatever, they tend to be cyclic. And so even when they're in remission and they're being handled really well by the patient, maybe the medication's controlling it, they've developed some better coping mechanisms, but still planning and understanding that there are going to be times when this is going to not be enough. I was telling a person the other day, they were recently put on some different medication for bipolar disorder, and it seemed to be controlling. It had been a couple of weeks. And we were talking about how with this person's kind of cycle, that their manic episode that they have like every couple of months may still come on, and the medicine is going to maybe help it not be as bad or not come on as often. But certainly it could kind of what I call bleed through the medication. And the same with depression. If somebody's on an antidepressant and they're doing really well, if something happens, they could still feel a sense of depression. And so it's really important to have a contingency plan. What are you going to do if? And for family members, what are you going to do if your child goes on a drinking binge and doesn't come home for several days? What are you going to do with your spouse if they get into depression and they won't go to work and they're just kind of sitting around? What are some contingency plans so that they're ready and they're not so surprised? And that's where that psychoeducational stuff comes in too, is what I call normalizing. I mean, a lot of this stuff, it's like it's going to be normal for them to slip up. It's going to be normal for their episodes to come around again, and you need to be ready for those.
Yeah, and a lot of times families are just so relieved to have a little respite, and so they're just saying, "Oh, thank goodness!" But we do need to be prepared if bad times roll around again. We hope for the best, but we also need to plan for the worst, just in case, because the worst won't be nearly as bad if we have a plan to deal with it.
Yeah, certainly, and sometimes people think, "Oh, I'm on the other side of this, and this is going to be over." Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we specify that it's a chronic serious mental illness, and sometimes you manage it. It's kind of like diabetes or high blood pressure. Yeah. You manage it. It's not necessarily going to go away.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and especially clients with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, those really we have to be vigilant and manage those because they typically are not going to spontaneously go away.
Certainly. Yeah. Certainly.
What about self-care? I think that self-care is very important for patients and families and loved ones. Would you talk a little bit about why it's important and if you have any tips as far as self-care, not only for the patient themselves, but also for loved ones and family members?
Certainly. Yeah. We talked about how family members can certainly get burned out dealing with their family members. And sometimes they're so hypervigilant trying to help their loved ones that they're not taking care of themselves. They're not going out because they're scared if they go out, then something could happen. I've worked with parents that have like teenage children, and they're scared to go away for the weekend, go to Dallas for a little weekend with just the adults, and leave their kids home alone and stuff. So it starts to impact relationships. But certainly self-care includes eating right, trying to take care of your body, your physical body, your spirit, having some timeouts away. So taking care of yourself, your hygiene, eating well, trying to get some sleep, trying to exercise a little bit or meditate. But those are the kind of things. And so I work with people and kind of identify if what kind of self-care. Some people want to get back involved in their church, or prayer is helpful for them. And so they kind of got away from that because of the stress of everything that's going on.
Yeah, and meditation, I have a lot of patients that are kind of resistant to it at first, but once they try it, so it's a inexpensive, no cost way to really help manage your stress, and you can even do it in little chunks if you have to. But yeah, that self-care is so important for the patients themselves, so that they don't so that their symptoms don't get worse, but then also for the families, because you are going to get burned out. It's a really difficult thing caring for a loved one who has serious mental illness, whether that be schizophrenia or Alzheimer's, or, you know, we see a lot of burnout in families who have loved ones with dementia. That's really difficult.
Certainly. Yeah. And along those lines with self-care is, with family members and stuff, is talking about boundaries. Having better appropriate boundaries with your loved ones and what you're going to be able to do and what you're not going to be able to do, and setting those firm boundaries with them is really helpful, and that's part of self-care as well.
Yeah, and I said this before, but I'll say it again. It's so important for family members, loved ones, to get counseling themselves, so that they can have some assistance with where do I set those boundaries? How do I set those boundaries? And also just having someone to vent to can be very helpful sometimes. A lot of these family members, they don't have anybody that they can go to and really talk to and unload some of this stuff on. So that can be very, very helpful. I wanted to talk a little bit about there is such a stigma attached to mental illness, in particular, you know, chronic, serious mental illness. And I feel like that there are a lot of incorrect assumptions about mental illness. Can you think of any? Would you mind sharing some of those incorrect assumptions that you have come across?
Well, I think with some of the misconceptions that people have about their chronic mental health is it's something that somebody's caused themselves, or if they would just try harder. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'll hear that from family members and say, you know, this person, they have this depression, but if they would just try harder, if they'd get off the couch, if they'd start exercising more, you know, there's more they could do to take care of this. And sometimes it's helpful when I'm able to have access to family members, is let them know that sometimes with the depression, the not being able to get up and get off the couch and do things and do the self-care and do the things that'll help you are really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I describe it as, you know, there's a chemical imbalance in the brain with many of these disorders. And with long-term depression or bipolar disorder, that's certainly the case. And so it makes it more difficult. It may be hard for me if I'm going through a tough time to get off the couch and get out there and run or something. I may have a long day, stressful day. It's like, oh, I just can't get off the couch. I'm just going to sit here and eat a bag of potato chips. But for someone with a chronic serious mental disorder, it's so much tougher to battle that. And so that's the reason that helping people understand those misconceptions of if they just tried harder, they could get on the other side of this. Are there some other areas you were thinking of?
Yeah, no,
of?
I mean, I think that's a great point, because a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of frustration. They just need to suck it up. They just need to, you know, get up, get out, just get on with their life. And it's not that easy. This really is, these illnesses really are diseases. They really do impact brain functioning. And so it's not just behavioral. You know, you can't just change your behavior and this is going to go away. Some of those behavioral interventions may help, but it's not quite as easy as it might be to the rest of us who don't have that chemical imbalance.
Sure. And I see some misconceptions kind of the opposite side of that coin, where the family members may think that this person cannot have a job, they can't take care of themselves, and so they start enabling that person to see that mental health disorder, and they kind of maybe feel sorry or have too much sympathy for someone, but their assumptions, their misconceptions may be on the other side, and so helping them see what the person can do, again, especially with kids and teenagers and stuff, but with older adults as well. Helping them figure out to be the best they can and to do the things that they can do.
Yeah, continuing to be productive and active and those sorts of things are always going to be helpful. And sometimes a gentle nudge is what's needed.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And again, I am joined by Andy Sibley. He is a licensed professional counselor, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and he has a private practice in Shreveport, Louisiana. So there are many different types of care that are available as far as intensity and frequency and so forth. I wanted to talk a little bit about the different levels of care, the different types of care, and when those types of care might be most appropriate.
Sure. So certainly there are what we call inpatient and outpatient is basically the two different types. But there's different levels of inpatient. There's different lengths of stays and what they're focusing on. There could be substance abuse focusing on that or some serious mental health issues that they're focusing on. Kind of getting people stabilized short-term and inpatient hospitalization is sometimes necessary. You had mentioned, Shelley, several outpatient, intensive outpatient, some day programs that are available for people, and certainly outpatient psychiatric visits and psychology visits and visits with counselors like myself that people just kind of come in after work or come in on their lunch break and go to counseling, and then they go back into their lives. And so there's different levels depending on their need and where they are in their recovery from their symptoms.
Yeah. We have Tina again calling back. We're glad to have a repeat customer. Tina, you can go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, okay, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'm just so interested because I could identify with all that you're all talking about, you know. And if people that are listening, okay, if they're not ashamed of what they're going through, it's not nobody's fault, okay? This is just something that has just happened, okay? And there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, I have a family member, I feel like I'm schizophrenic, or there's something different about my husband, or whatever it is, you know, if we go to try to get some kind of help and realize what's going on, that we're able to help each other. And then also, what I learned when I was going through in my family, it was that I might not be able to help them, but I knew the signs, but I was able to help other families. You know how you get together in a setting, and you got to, you know, get to talking and stuff. I might be invited to your house and become a friend of yours, okay? I might be able to help your family member, you know, as well as you could help my family member, okay? It's like each one teach one, you know?
Sure.
And a lot of people are embarrassed. Don't be embarrassed what's going on. You have to do what you need to do to try to help them. And because you can't doesn't mean that you're not powerless, but you have people that have been through it. And it's not that that's going to be the same issue, but different people attract different people. Even though you're a different nationality, different stripes, whatever, the problem is there. And people have to realize it. There's a lot more out there to help you than you really think there is. But you need to participate, you know. Again, like I said, you know, I'm so interested in this program. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to say that I had family members in my family and my mom and dad. I'm not embarrassed about that. I needed help at that time. If I didn't make that step, I would have not learned what I have learned and be able to be compassionate, you know, for other families. And there's other people out there that don't have any family, okay? But then you have you see what they're going through. You could reach out and touch them and say, you know, would you care to have a cup of coffee with me?
you know, and then you have references on places and that you went to, you know, and tell them, well, you know what, well, I'm going to a meeting over here. Would you care to join me? You know, but...
Hey, Tina, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think it's really neat that you're talking about people getting rid of the stigma associated with mental health in their families and being more open. And when you're more open and letting folks know what you're going through, then people like you and people, their friends, can step in and be helpful. You never know who is going to be able to say things in a certain way that a family member or a patient is going to hear in a certain way that's going to really help them. And you talked about sharing your expertise, sharing your experiences and knowing what resources are out there. So it's really, I really appreciate what you're saying about people kind of opening up and allowing, you just never know when you have a friend or another relative that may be able to step in and really help you, especially with some of these families that are kind of burned out.
And we have another caller, but we're not going to have time to get to him. Danny, I apologize. Please call back another time. I wish we had time to get to you. We have just a couple more minutes, so I wanted to see if you have any parting wisdom, suggestions, comments, anything to share with the listeners.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Shelley, to be here and get to talk to people on the telephone and help them. And I hope they've learned some things. I hope they get an idea. If they have any questions, certainly they're welcome to call my office or email me and ask their questions. I'll be glad to answer those. And I hope they take some of what we talked about and look at their families and see if they can help use this information.
Yeah, yeah. Just as we said, you know, it's a team. It takes a village.
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah. Thank you again, Andy. We appreciate you being here. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, and production assistance was provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Sheila Lawrence. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Tune in each Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.